Sunday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast, the long-awaited first 15-60 of the year. The Western Conference, for those who aren't familiar with this concept from last year, basically we try to talk about all 15 teams in the Western Conference in 60 minutes. We rarely actually make it in 60 minutes, but we try to spend about 5 minutes per team or so, and it ends up usually being an hour 15 or an hour 30, maybe even more than that, we'll see. But Danny, let's get started with the Dallas Mavericks. And also I should say too that we are sponsored today by SeatGeek. You can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase via rebate by entering that CapSpace code at checkout. And then also our friends at Helix Sleep, helixsleep.com/CapSpace. That'll get you $50 off your order for the best custom-made mattress delivery service that I am aware of, certainly. So what should we just put the record, any other information we should include about these teams at this point, or is there not really much else, you think?
I mean, we could have some fun and do the 538 playoff percentages, but I think it's just too early for that. they do have them out if you dig through 538 stuff, but I think so. So with a lot of these teams, though, what's important to remember is that the record isn't everything. There's a lot of context that you don't get through that through sample sizes and everything else. But I think Dallas is an example where the actual wins and losses matter because they won today. Congratulations. They beat the Milwaukee Bucks. First win of the year in overtime. And the problem for them is just, we talked about this a little bit a couple days ago, is just the numbers game, that they're going to have to pick up wins because it doesn't feel like a team that's going to go on this like 10-2 run or something like that.
Yeah, every win for them is really going to be grinding it out against, I think, maybe some of the worst teams in the league at home they can win pretty handily against. But the issue, of course, is that Dirk Nowitzki has this recurring Achilles soreness. He missed a couple of games, said that he felt like he was ready to go for Friday's game, and then after the first half, the same soreness returned, and so now he's going to be shut down indefinitely. And then Deron Williams was listed as very questionable with a sore groin, that the same that had bothered him throughout camp. He played on Friday, and now a sore calf kept him out today, and calves, another injury that really can linger quite a bit, and Deron always seems to have some sort of recurring muscle issues. So now at 1-5, they desperately needed this win. This was a huge win for them. And if they do come back, we may look back on that win against the Bucks, who were kind of rolling actually, and had a 6-point lead in the fourth quarter. We may look at that as a key moment, but they are at the Lakers, who are on fire right now, on Tuesday. Wednesday, they're at Warriors, and then they have 4 days off, but then they're at Knicks and at Celtics. And you have to imagine that Dirk is going to miss at least these next two games. Maybe he can come back for that Monday game, but really, even if he is back, none of those games are gimmies. And I mean, what do you, if you had to guess what their record's going to be at the end of that stretch, they'll have played 10 games. What do you think it would be?
So I think they'll be, so they're 1-5 now. I think they'll be 2-8 or 3-7. But if I had to say, I'd say they'll be 2-8, just because the Lakers and Knicks are probably the most likely, but the Knicks have had some really nice stretches too. So it's not like that's a gimme. It's on the road, and the Deron, like, we don't know what's going to be happening with him. And Dirk, if it's your first game back from that kind of an injury, you never know if there's going to be a recurrence. You never know if there's going to be anything else. And so I think that they're not the favorites in any of these games, except possibly the game on Tuesday. And the Lakers are playing well.
Yeah. I mean, they're, I would say that they are definitely, I mean, without Dirk and without Deron Williams, they're absolutely underdogs in all those games. Maybe if they're lucky, they win one of them, to me. But yeah, 2-8, 1-9. That's what that stretch says to me. And that's really a concern for this team, and we'll see. I mean, it's too bad in some respects, because really Harrison Barnes has been playing really at the absolute high end of what could have been expected from him at this point.
Yeah, he's done a much better job of creating off the dribble than we saw when he was on the Warriors, and he's still not getting to the line, but he is a more complete offensive player, and the defensive effort has been fine. You know, I haven't seen anything that screams stopper to me, but he's doing enough to be a positive for them. And that's, you know, I mean, that seems like a low bar considering he just got his maximum, but he's a more complete player than he showed last year.
Yeah, his moves off the dribble do look improved, and we were all worried about him because remember, he shot like 22% or whatever it was in preseason, but he's been excellent. A lot of what he's been doing may be a little unsustainable because he's shooting very well on ISOs, very well on contested jumpers, but he has shown some shake. I mean, he had some great moves, and it got so bad that they were running, you know, 1-3 pick and rolls with he and Barea, getting a small on him, and basically every bucket that the Mavs got in that dominating overtime was either him scoring or him getting a switch, the defense overcommitting to him to prevent the entry or helping out too much. And then that opened things up for other people. So it's really remarkable that he became that much of a threat. But I think he had 34 points in this game. And really, without him, you know, they would be 0-6 right now.
Something else that should give Mavericks fans some solace is that before Sunday's game, because it hasn't been incorporated yet into it, opponents were shooting 43.5% from three against them, which is the highest in the NBA by a long shot. The next closest was 39%. And generally speaking, that is something that is more, let's call it a luck characteristic. So you would expect that that will regress to the mean. And to give you a little bit of reference on what 43.5% means, only five players in the NBA shot better than that last season.
Yeah, and the good news for the Mavs too, you mentioned that, and the Bucks were way off on their threes in this game. That's part of why they ended up losing. But the Mavs have two things that they can feel good about. One is they're defending. They're only allowing 99.7 points per 100 possessions per NBA.com, and that is the sixth best in the league at the moment. Now, they haven't played any juggernauts necessarily, and they only, for being 1-5, they only have a negative 2.7 net rating. And you think if Dirk comes back, that can fix the offense. Now, the problem is when Dirk comes back, they're not going to be as good defensively, but I think they can maybe just hope to slow things down, grind it out the way they did down the end of last season as they went on a winning streak, just have Rick Carlisle call every play, and then they can switch a lot defensively, have Bogut down there as an anchor. Guys like Matthews, Barnes, Justin Anderson, if he's going to play, Dorian Finney-Smith actually got a lot of run in this game, didn't do much offensively, but was pretty good on defense. He's a rookie that I had never even heard of coming into the year. So maybe your hope is they just slow it down. They can maybe force teams into a brutal game like they did with the Bucks today and get one or two more wins while Dirk is out. Andrew Bogut played a little bit better in this game, but going into the game, he only had an 8.9 PR, and he also was playing less than 20 minutes per game. So for all the Warriors fans, you're like, oh, they missed Bogut so much. Well, it's not like Bogut's been lighting the world afire either. And the pairing with him and Dirk Nowitzki is tough because those guys are both slow as molasses. Neither one of them can switch. And so I think down the end of games, even when Dirk was healthy, they felt like they needed more mobility to deny penetration because they're just either going to give up a ton of threes, or if those guys got out there, then they were just going to blow by for layups.
And when you have two bigs that are uncomfortable defending in space, which is a lot of times when somebody's slow, what it can affect, that means that a team can use either one of their bigs as the kind of as the screener in a high pick and roll. And that can, you can't really game plan for that. You just kind of have to grin and bear it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you think about it, if you're trying to play 2-on-2, Bogut's hanging back on the pick and roll. Now you're putting Dirk in a situation where he's got to help or close out on a shooter if the other team is playing with someone who can shoot at the four. So it may be an untenable defensive pairing, even if in a vacuum, Bogut is someone who is a pretty decent defensive player with the right guys around him. All right, we're going to get to the red hot Denver Nuggets, at least after one game, blowing out the Celtics today. But first, this from Helix Sleep. Helix Sleep is a sponsor that I actually sought out because I love their product so much. I had purchased another mattress with my girlfriend from another mattress delivery company that only offered one style of mattress. It was basically, take this and you're going to like it. This is the mattress forever. Well, that didn't turn out to be the case for me. We were both very uncomfortable and we ended up having to return it. So she actually did some research and found Helix Sleep. What's so unique about Helix Sleep is you actually can fill out a questionnaire and they will create a mattress that fits your preferences, both in terms of how hot it is when you're trying to sleep, if you sleep cold, if you sleep hot, the level of firmness that you would like. And if you and your significant other have significantly different preferences, you can even get a mattress that's split down the middle. It's really the best bed that I've ever slept on, and it's a million times cheaper than going to a department store or a mattress store. They start at just around $600 for a twin and going up to a little over $1,000 for the California King that my girlfriend and I so enjoy. And of course, it wouldn't be a Dunked On ad if you didn't get a discount. You can go to helixsleep.com/capspace. Capspace is easy to remember because we talk about it all the time on the program. helixsleep.com/capspace. They'll get you $50 off your order. Also, let them know that you came from us, so they will continue advertising, and I hope they do because I really enjoy shilling for them because it's a fantastic product. helixsleep.com/capspace is that URL. The Denver Nuggets 3-3 after absolutely throttling Boston today.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those games that just kind of boggles your mind because it was at the Garden, you know, in Boston generally, they play reasonably well at home. And also it boggles the mind because of how Emmanuel Mudiay started.
I had written down before this game, Zach Lowe tweeted out, like, at some point, Mudiay is going to have to hit a shot. And I thought that he had looked good. I even said I thought his jump shot just looked better. But this is why you need stats, because even though he's looked good in some of these games, he was shooting 27.1% from the field, still had a 27% usage and over 20% turnover rate. So a 6.0 PER for Mudiay echoes of how he started last season, and perhaps even worse when he had one of the least efficient starts to a season in NBA history. And then he dropped 24 in the first quarter.
Yeah. And I mean, you do have a lot of the unsustainable vibes from that, just that he was making tough shots. But, you know, it's still good to see it happen every once in a while. And you can call that just kind of the karmic balancing from everything else.
Yeah, I mean, at least he has the capability to hit like this. But yeah, he went on this stretch where he hit a contested long two. Then he hit three contested threes in a row. And then he had another sweet shot in the post that was a tough contested two. And he went from 14 points in the quarter, which was right when I started watching, to 24 just in the blink of an eye. It might have even been 12. And it was just a remarkable performance. They were up by 20 at the end of the first quarter and never really looked back at all. And just the offense was totally unstoppable. Up until that game, the offense had actually kind of been the problem. They were 26th in offense going into tonight. I mean, let's for some of these teams, you know, we kind of had a conception of them. Their over under was 37. I think you took the over. I might have barely taken it as well. I can't remember whether I did the over or under, but I felt like the 37 was pretty good. Has what's happened so far changed your conception of what you think this team might be?
Not really. And one of the other reasons, a guy that I've been interested in is Wilson Chandler. And so Chandler coming off the bench for them, he's only played in, you know, five games. Oh, I'm not sure if they have the stats, and I think he did miss one. But what I found interesting is that he's averaging over 14 points a game, but he's only shooting 20% from three. So he could balance that out a little bit. He's been more efficient than usual in terms of his 2-point scoring, but he's also making fewer free throws than usual. So if Chandler can be one of those added pieces, whether that be that he comes off the bench or starts, and that'll depend. Also, Gary Harris, this was the first game he played in all year. So if they can piece this together, they won't have to use as much Jameer Nelson and a lot of the other things. I think they can be a respectable team, and something that we'll have to see if it carries over. And there's some reasons to think this isn't as great for them as it is for other teams. They're tied for the league lead in free throw attempt rate, which is proportion, you know, basically how many free throw attempts you have relative to how many shots you take. Generally speaking, that is a very good thing, but that might also be because they're pounding it a little bit, maybe too much inside.
Yeah, Yusuf Nurkic, he actually has been closing some of these games. Other games, they've been going with Fareed at center and then Chandler and Gallo around him. And Nurkic is actually averaging 6.4 post-ups a game and not averaging a great efficiency there, only 0.77 points per possession going into today's game. And he loves to post up. I get that. He will try to get deep position. I think that that's effective. But straight post-ups for him, he just doesn't quite have the explosion. And I think that there are enough other options on this team to go to that you don't necessarily want to go there. Although I guess it's a lot more efficient than what Mudiay had been up until today. So you can say that.
That's true.
For him.
One other thing I wanted to mention before we move on is that, again, dealing with small sample sizes, Denver's only played one home game so far this year. They've played five road games, one home game. And that one home game was that brutal loss they had to the Portland Trailblazers, which, you know, they tied the game at the end of regulation. Portland tied at the end of regulation, then Portland won in overtime. So Denver, broadly speaking, has a nice home court advantage. And if they push it with their second unit, it could be stronger this year than it was last year. So that could also go in their favor because now they have a bank of four more road games than home games already logged.
I will answer my own question actually too, which was, I feel more secure actually about them potentially even being a 500 team. They just have a lot of depth on this squad. Nurkic looks better than we thought he would. Gallo's had a little bit of a slow start, although he had a fantastic dunk on Tyler Zeller today. But I think he'll come around. There's no reason to think that he won't. Chandler is kind of getting back in the swing of things. Mudiay is going to shoot better than he has, even if it's not going to be amazing. Gary Harris is kind of their big 3-and-D option on the wing. So I think that there's no reason to believe they're not going to defend this well, probably, but they'll shoot better. I think this could be a 500 team. Like, it kind of feels like it. They've had some nice wins. They had that win at Minnesota, which I think was a really good one. They controlled that game. Blowing out the Celtics like this is certainly a positive. That Portland game, they probably should have won. So there's, and they won at New Orleans, who hasn't been that terrible either. So I think the last question I want to ask you, though, is what do you think is their best closing lineup in a vacuum, especially in their front court? Obviously, it's going to be Moutier at the one. And I guess even going down to the two as well. I mean, like, who do you think you would go with here? Malone has been mixing and matching, hasn't been going to Jokic at all. It's kind of been Nurkic or Fareed. But what do you think?
I would probably, it does depend on the circumstance and the opponent, but I would probably say Moutier, Harris, Chandler, Gallo, and whichever one of the centers is playing better. I generally would lean Jokic, but it would depend on circumstance. Nurkic is, I think he's the better interior defender. So if it's a team that is driving more, maybe you want to go in that direction. But I also think that having Gary Harris there, if you just sick him on whoever the other team's more dangerous guard is, that will limit penetration a little bit and maybe make it more palatable to play Jokic.
Yeah, maybe that's right. And Jokic, I think, is the best offensive option of those guys, but he definitely has been a liability defensively. It's been tough for him because he's had to play power forward a lot of the time alongside Nurkic. That's been the starting lineup.
A la Greg Monroe when he was in the Pistons.
Well, at least Jokic can shoot, though. Like, I think that's actually a totally fine pairing.
Well, I just think defensively, it's kind of like the thing of where you look bad because you're not supposed to look good.
Yeah. They have not been able to stop anybody with that lineup. And Fareed, at least, has been able to get into a stance and slide a little bit better than I recall him doing. So, and the fact that he's not starting, I think maybe that is finally, that'll be the motivation to fulfill his defensive potential. Who knows? It's only been a few games, but I think he's looked okay in that role. So you do have a lot of different options you can go to. You can go offense. You can go with the big center who can protect the rim and rebound, hit the offensive glass. Fareed will get on the offensive glass too. You switch with that lineup. So they have a lot of ways that they can go. None of those are particularly dominating alignments, but they work. At least they can match up. All right, who we got next here?
A team that we never discuss at all on the Dunked On Basketball podcast, the Golden State Warriors, who are 4-2.
Yeah, it was so funny that we had this conversation about, oh, are they fine now? We're good on them after that Thunder win. And then they went out and just laid a complete egg against the Lakers. And again, they were just totally off on threes, even wide open threes. Is that all it is? Is that the only problem here?
No, there are a couple of different problems. In this game against the Lakers, a lot of it was effort-based. They were just getting beat to the spot by the guards. Clarkson, Lou Williams had a great game. You know, they were getting to the spots. And then also, in a very rare occurrence, Draymond Green was just getting beat by Julius Randle. Randle was out-hustling him. It was more out-hustling than out-muscling, but that certainly does happen sometimes. And another big structural thing that we're going to have to see 20-30 games in is that right now the Warriors are second from the bottom in defensive rebounding, and that was a strength of, you know, having traditional centers that were more stout defensively and everything like that. They were in position and coverage, and also pick and roll defense has been a big problem. But if, let's say, even if that gets to like 10th from the bottom in the league, it's going to be a little bit harder even if their first shot defense is pretty good. However, I consider that a regular season problem, not a playoff problem, because it could motivate Kerr to just go to the small lineup more often.
Yeah, we'll see whether that ends up happening, and presumably they're not panicking at all. Steph Curry's three-point streak came to an end at, I think, 157 games. He was 0-for-10. Klay couldn't hit a shot either. KD has been really the most reliable guy, and he, I think, inherently his game is a little bit more consistent because he gets to the foul line and he can score in the mid-range and get to the basket. He's getting a ton of dunks. He's getting like four dunks a game, KD is, which is more than he was getting in Oklahoma City. And we talked about how he should be getting more spot-up attempts with this team as well. I'm not ready to hit the panic button yet. I mean, I think both of their losses, if they had just made threes at the normal rate that they do, they would have been right in those games. And maybe the defense, I do think that they are somewhat subject to falling apart on defense when those threes aren't falling and getting frustrated, which is definitely a concern, but something that I think they can work through. The other note that I had on them, and obviously we talk about them, so we don't have to spend too much time on it. Steph Curry, only 31st in the NBA, using only 5.8 pick and roll possessions per game as probably the best pick and roll point guard in the NBA. It would be nice to see him get a few more of those chances. They are trying to be more egalitarian, get everyone involved. And then Kevin Durant, he's using less than 2 possessions a game as a pick and roll ball handler. And while Kerr, again, loves to move the ball and get everybody involved, I think that they have so many good players now that it might just be easier to let them create a little bit more often. But again, that's something that is going to be a small problem. They're not going to change things up. You know, if they're 15 and 10 or something, then maybe they'll start to make some changes, but that's not really their style to do any sort of major adjustments. I did notice one thing that they did, though, was they actually changed up and had Pachulia up pressuring the ball on pick and rolls. Not necessarily trapping, but at least getting up to the level of the ball and forcing the ball handler to make a pass, because Pachulia just had not been good enough laying back in the pick and roll, which is their preferred style. And so and Mike Brown actually used to really like to play that way. That's how they played in Cleveland. And so I would guess, I'll have to ask them this actually, of like whose suggestion it was to start playing that way, but that seems like it might have been a Mike Brown suggestion. And in some respects, it seemed to work a little bit better, but that also then left the defensive glass vulnerable, and they gave up a lot of cuts as well without someone back there. So it remains to be seen if they're going to stick with that with Pachulia and with West as well. But those guys have not been good enough protecting the rim, just laying back in normal pick and roll defense.
Yeah, agreed. But I think it's time to move on to the Rockets. They are 3-3 with some weird games in there. But I think the best encapsulation of their season so far is that the main one of the biggest of the four factors, they in the Western Conference, they are top in effective field goal percentage and bottom in opponent effective field goal percentage.
Yeah, overall, sixth in offense by points per possession, 29th in defense, a negative 1.3 net rating overall. They've had some real stinkers. They've had games where they've blown out the Knicks. And their biggest problem, though, is just the offense is really good. I mean, the defense is going to be bad probably no matter who they have on the court. And it certainly has been so far. And Gordon and Anderson, like, they have not been able to defend just as you would expect when those guys are on the floor. Capella not experienced enough to make up for that. Neither is Nene. But when Harden's on the floor, they're plus 7.5 points per 100 possession. And he plays three quarters of the game. So to have a negative rating rating when your star, you're plus 7.5, they have to be awful with him off the floor, and they have been negative 30.3 net rating, only an 80 offensive rating with him off the floor. And that's just going to continue. They don't have anybody else who can dribble and attack the paint on this team. They really don't.
And I mean, eventually when Patrick Beverley gets back, he can do that, but he's not really a maestro. He's more of a kind of a complimentary piece for somebody like Harden, because he's a better defender than he is creator. And so it is just a problem that this team is going to have to deal with. And it's hard to make up for that with system. You can try, but it's brutal. And so maybe you want to try to, especially if they feel like there's good cohesion in the starting lineup. And, you know, the Gordon Harden thing is working out relatively well. And let's say they're doing everything. Maybe you go just completely different for your second unit and try to make it more of a survival thing than a thrive thing.
Yeah, Bob Vilgaris has always talked about this, that when your star's out of the game, maybe you just slow the pace down to an absolute crawl. And especially when Patrick Beverley comes back, maybe you just run him at point guard. You have either Nene or Capella, whoever you think is a better defender. Bring Trevor Ariza back as well. And then maybe guys like McDaniels or Decker, those guys have actually been pretty effective so far compared to what maybe people would have thought. And you just say, all right, we're going to put our absolutely best defensive lineup out here and hope to just not get killed during this time. Like, we'll slow it down. We're going to make sure we're not going to turn it over. And you know what? We're just going to have two possessions per minute, basically, and hope that James can get back in the game pretty quickly. That's one thought. And then I guess the other one is maybe you just try to make Eric Gordon the primary creator on the second unit, split him up with Harden, which I don't think they've done much of yet, but I don't know that Eric Gordon is really dynamic enough to make much of a difference there.
Especially when he would be the entire focus of the defense. Like, when you have one guy like that, you can, even though second units generally don't have great defenders on them, you can put a lot of juice at him, and that will be really hard to handle.
Just getting Beverly back, I think, will help too. Although, you know, Anderson or Gordon or any of these, Nene could go down at any time. So I think even though Beverly's out, they're probably more healthy on average right now than they will be at later points in the season. But if they can just get Tyler Ennis out of the rotation, I think that'll help too. Just having one more quality player, because Ennis just can't do anything. I mean, he can pass a little bit, but he's not really that good on defense. He can't hit a shot. He's not aggressive at all. He's not a threat. So the fact that he is the point guard when Harden is out of the game, that's something that I think is really holding that second unit back as well. Any other thoughts on these guys? I guess one other that I had too is the offense has been great when Harden's been out there, and they are averaging 15.2 wide open threes taken per game. And unlike in past years, they got guys who can knock those shots down. And Harden is obviously creating those. He has been an absolute monster in the pick and roll, averaging 1.22 points per possession on plays that he's finishing. And that's usually the pick and roll ball handler that usually averages around 0.8 on those half court type of plays. And he's doing 12 per game. That's up from 7.4 per game last year. So he really is being put in a better position to succeed, both with the shooting and just having the ball in his hands more from Mike D'Antoni. And so that the offense has been as dynamic as we thought it would be when he was on the floor.
Yeah. And if they can keep up, you know, if they can, they're going to need to win more than this to make him an MVP candidate, but he's going to have the counting stats. That's not a question at all.
Yeah. Do you feel any differently about them than you, as an overall team, than you did at the start of the year? They're at 3-3, as we mentioned.
Maybe marginally more confident as long as Harden stays healthy, just because the offense, we always expected it to work, but it has, and there is a difference between expectation and reality. And so to bridge that gap is definitely encouraging, and the fact that they don't have Beverly right now, so it kind of makes sense that their backups have been shaky, and that's something that you can correct with, you know, maybe you can't fix it, but at least you can mitigate it, and so they have time to figure that out.
Well, the hope for these guys was that they could be passable on defense, and they're not there yet. 29th is not good enough. I actually feel a little bit worse about them than I did, and the fact that even when Harden is off the floor and Gordon and Anderson are out, they're not stopping anybody then either, so that's a concern. I mean, if they're going to be 25th or worse in defense, they're not going to be as good as we thought they're going to be. I think I had them at 46 wins and a solid playoff team with even like a 50 win upside potentially. And so the defense is just going to have to get better. Maybe it can. I don't feel like they've had a particularly tough schedule. Do you?
No, they haven't had a particularly tough schedule yet. And they're facing the Spurs twice this week, so that will change.
The LA Clippers 5-1 after an absolute throttling of the Spurs. They beat them by like 30. First team really to slow down Kawhi Leonard. Luka Mbamute actually had a wonderful game. He had 13 points. He's had a couple of games actually where he scored reasonably well. We had talked that maybe Allen Anderson could be the best option there in the preseason. That's has not been the case so far. He's been getting DMPs. But Luke, at least if he can be like, you know, if he can get you 8 points, 10 points a game, and he really is very well suited as kind of a combo forward defender to guard Kawhi Leonard, because he's strong enough to not get knocked backwards. But the way that's, I mean, that's the big thing that you need if you're guarding Kawhi, is just that strength to not let him shoulder you off on the post or on his ISOs. So this is the top defensive team in the league right now. It's pretty impressive.
It's incredibly impressive. And they're doing a couple of big things that you like to see with a defensive team. And also, one thing before I get into the stats is that they're doing this with Most Bates as their second unit center. So like he has been, let's say, defensively challenged in his career. And so,
yeah, we thought that DJ Foster and I talked about this on the Clippers preview. We thought that they could just suck on the second unit defensively, and they've been fine so far.
Yeah, they've been fine so far. So a couple of key things that good defenses do that the Clippers are accomplishing at an incredible rate. So they're second in the league in both opponent effective field goal percentage, so shooting, and they're forcing the second most turnovers relative to amount of possessions. So they have those are two key tenets in good defense, but also they're forcing the fewest threes per game in the entire league. And that's really impressive to have those three things together. It like you probably they probably aren't going to be able to keep all three of the legs of that stool, but even with two of them, that's enough for a solid defense.
Part of what's been so good for them is they've just been switching everything a lot. And mm-hmm. Blake Griffin has been good at that. They've got DeAndre Jordan as a help guy. He can switch out if he has to late in the clock. You'd think that they would take advantage of guys like Crawford and Redick, but just they're on a string enough that taking advantage of those guys in the post hasn't really worked very well. And I guess the defense has been a revelation. The offense, however, and you noted that they're shooting a bad percentage, but they're also giving up few looks. So I think that part of it can sustain. And one of the hallmarks of switching is you cut down on assists and you also cut down on open threes, because you're just you're not allowing penetration. There's not that many guys who are going to just shoot off the dribble to get a three on a switch. And I think that the league is just going to have to get better at attacking switches. Like the Lakers are killing people with switching defense too. Like there's going to need to be a strategic revolution. And I think that there can be, but for now, switching is really just killing people. especially teams that are not that smart. But the offense has struggled a little bit for them. Part of it has been Blake Griffin. He has been off on his jump shot. We talked about that a little bit on Thursday's program. He's taking most of his jumpers from the top of the circle, as he often does, but he's only 5 out of 17 from up there. So that's where a lot of times they'll run that pick and roll, Paul throw it to him, and teams are just kind of laying back in the lane, and they're content to let Blake fire away, and he has not been able to convert.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of have to think about the Clippers in two different mindsets. One is the regular season and one is the playoffs. And what I've seen from them is more that they're going to be a really good regular season team, which was always a possibility, especially if they can stay healthy. But a lot of kind of the switching and everything like that will work a lot better than in the playoffs, when teams can game plan for it and you get more of those superlative individual talents that can attack that kind of a scheme.
JJ Redick also has struggled. And I think the reason for that compared to last year is that Blake is back and just the spacing is not there. You used to have it where they'd run a pick and roll. DeAndre Jordan would come down the lane. And if Redick was on the backside, that's what smart teams do. You put your best shooter on the backside of a pick and roll. So now you put the guy guarding him in a bind. He's either got to get over to the rim to prevent the alley-oop, and you with DeAndre Jordan, you got to get way over, or he'll stick home and then it's going to be an alley-oop. So making Redick's man cover both the rim and him got him a lot of open looks last year. And this year he's not getting as many of those because with Blake Griffin, there isn't that level of distance to help because there's the spacing isn't as large. But I still think if you want to say, oh, they're better off without Blake Griffin, I disagree with that. I mean, he had an unbelievable first quarter against San Antonio as they got out to the lead. And there are a lot of teams that just can't deal with Blake Griffin. And I think they still have a high enough upside if he's really clicking that in the playoffs, to be sure, they're much harder to guard when he's at full tilt.
Yeah, they definitely need him, though that has given more ammunition to people like me who think that a full-on stagger would help them, with the idea of having him be...
Yeah, they haven't been doing that at all, but they haven't needed to. The bench would be good.
But I mean, I think that you could see that kind of have a few different benefits, and you don't necessarily want it against everyone, because there are some teams that would just kind of attack that very different Clippers team, because when the Clippers are going, they'd be going more with a four like Wes Johnson or something like that. There are a lot of ways to attack that, and they're not, you know, different kind of strength and everything like that, but it's worth considering, and it just to give Blake that kind of stability and comfort level with that, and the Clippers starters play enough minutes that it's not like you're dealing with this like massive change. It's more of just thinking about his rest a little bit differently.
Last note on them, Mo Spates is ahead of Brandon Bass in the rotation. When they both signed, we wondered who it would be. Bass has barely been playing. Spates has just been playing as the lone big on some of those second units, as you mentioned, and I think that's really helped their scoring. He's continued to shoot three-pointers, and he hasn't been so incredibly terrible defensively, so that's been a useful signing so far. Would you say that the 4-3 Los Angeles Lakers are the biggest surprise team in the league at the moment?
Yeah, I would say so.
And I don't even know who the competition would be at this point. I mean, at least for good surprises.
Yeah, I mean, Milwaukee at one point, like they had that 3-game winning streak. That was nice, and we weren't expecting it. But Milwaukee has those kind of high-end talents, you know, like
they're and Milwaukee also hasn't beaten anybody on.
Right, know. I think it was Orlando and, you know, kind of teams.
Yeah,
of
the
that
Kings
ilk.
And yeah, so.
But the Lakers, yeah, I mean, they and not only that, but they've been competitive in some of the games that they've lost. And I think that the game I watched most closely for them, unsurprising considering my writing obligations, was when they played the Warriors. And they did a great job of just effort and effort plays and defense. Like they don't have a lot of let's call it defensive talent, and it's not like their results are amazing on that end, but they're getting it done, and getting it done keeps you in games, and they have enough firepower that sometimes they win those games.
I'd say they have maybe two of the three best wins so far, beating the Hawks, who actually lead the league in net rating right now on the road. Hawks have a very good defense. They lit up that Hawks defense. And then that Warriors game as well. I mean, I think any win over them still, I mean, maybe they'll continue to be not as good as we thought, but I think for right now, I'm still going to consider them as being pretty good. And then that Spurs win at Oakland being the other one that I would look at as one of the best. So they really have been fantastic. D'Angelo Russell has been solid. One thing that's really interesting is that Luol Deng and Timofey Mozgov really just are not even close to being in the rotation at the end of games. And Deng, even tonight, it was Ingram over him. Even even with Larry Nance out, you would have thought maybe they'll go with Dang at the four. Instead, they went with Ingram at the four and Randall at the five. And that switching that they've been doing at the end of games, they locked up Houston with that. The Hawks weren't able to really score very well against them either down the end of the game. And then today they were tied, I think, at 92 against Phoenix. And then they went on like a 20-6 run or whatever it was. And Phoenix just couldn't get a decent shot either. And all they were doing was just switching and then showing good help and good activity. And I mean, it's really remarkable how few teams can deal with that. And really, Julius Randle is the guy who's the linchpin of that. He and Nick Young, actually. Nick Young has been outstanding on defense.
Yeah, and Luke Walton deserves credit for getting especially those two guys to really buy in and having a system that does the best of kind of maximizing the positives in those guys' games and minimizing some of the negatives. And really, that's what a defensive scheme should do. However, it is important to note that there are a couple warning signs. We talked about this with the Knicks last year, or a little bit early on in the season, where they were looking a little bit better on that end than we expected. And so the Lakers are giving up the fourth most opponent threes, which is generally something you can do a better job of controlling. And opponents are shooting below 30%, actually below 28% before Sunday's game on that. And so what that screams is that at some point those shots are going to go in, and then they're pulling the ball out of the basket a little bit more and everything like that. So there's plenty of reason to be optimistic. Even that sort of a regression would still put them in a more positive place than I expected, but it is worth noting all the same.
Also, Julius Randle is not going to continue to shoot 83% in the restricted area and then 58% from 3 to 9 feet, where the league average is about 40%. Like, that's not going to continue either. Lou Williams, same thing. He's shooting crazy percentages close to the rim. And a lot of guys are shooting pretty well on threes for them. One interesting thing about D'Angelo Russell, not getting to the rim at all and not really finishing when he gets there either. Not a ton of shots here, but only 36% in the restricted area for Russell, but he's shooting 46% on long twos, 32% from three. So he really is, he's going to have to find a way to get a little bit more efficient to be the player that we all think that he could be. And that's why he's not necessarily playing as much as you would have thought. He's only shooting 36% with not a ton of free throws so far on the season. Anything else you wanted to say about these guys?
Yeah, one kind of big picture thing. I forgot to put this note in, but you just tied into it well, which is I had expected that if the Lakers outperformed expectations, part of it would be a defensive improvement, but then the other part would be D'Angelo Russell taking a big step because he has a higher offensive ceiling and, you know, maybe he was being underutilized last year. And they've done this without him really being a standout. And that can be considered a negative because he's not doing it. But if you're more of a Russell optimist like I am, then maybe that gives you an idea that they could kick this in a little bit more if they can get more offensively from him. So that can offset some of the coming back to earth defensively.
Yeah, the four guys who really have been pushing this start has been Randall, who's been fantastic on both ends. Lou Williams, oh yeah, that's right, he's good. Remember him, the sixth man of the year, and then he goes to the Lakers, and you forget that so he's now on a steal of a contract, and I would wonder if a team that needs some offense might be interested in trading for him and actually giving up a first rounder for him. So he's still under contract for another year or two, but as long as they're playing well, you don't think they're going to go out of their way to move him. Nick Young, getting what they're getting out of him, he's averaging 25 minutes a game, still only shooting 39%, and so maybe he'll get to the point where it's just not going to be he won't be efficient enough to stay out there at age 31. And then Larry Nance has been great too. He's been in that closing lineup until he got a concussion today. Last thing I wanted to say too, there's a great scene. I mean, Randall really kind of helped bring them home against the Suns today, and he got into it with Tyson Chandler after Tyson Chandler was called for a loose ball foul, and then they both got double technicals. It was like the end of a pickup game, basically, where we've all had it where there's one guy who's been taking all the shots the whole time, and so he just sort of danced around at the top of the circle with Chandler guarding him. Then Devin Booker came over too closely, and he fired a bullet pass to Clarkson for a wide open three, and he nailed it, and that was the game. It was just a great moment for Randall to do all that talking and then actually find someone with a pass instead of just doing the young player, like, I'm going to go against the 7-footer type of play. And you could tell that he really enjoyed that. And Luke Walton has these guys playing a fun team first brand of basketball.
From an encouraging offensive play to the Memphis Grizzlies.
Yeah, Chandler Parsons came back for the first time today. 0 of 8 and 2 turnovers for him. So I went and looked at his synergy numbers, and he was 10 possessions at 0 points, which is pretty ugly. Again, he's a guy I think it takes a little bit to get back, but you know, he at least has experience experience trying to work back from these knee issues, but didn't look to have a ton of explosion. That's to be expected. No panicking.
He's an injury recovery veteran.
Is that what I said, or is that what you're saying?
No, that's what I'm thinking. Like how Elgin Baylor was a lottery veteran. Like you have experience doing something. But for me, the biggest thing with Memphis so far has been, you could make a very good argument that they've been the worst offense in the league. And, you know, they're third in offense, third from the bottom in offensive rating, ahead of the Sixers and the Pelicans. But I mean, just watching when you watch them, it's kind of like car crashes and things like that. And they've had some nice moments, like when Marc Gasol randomly hit four threes and helped win them a game. But I just have trouble visualizing with their depth and everything else. Like, they're not dead. They're far from dead in the water. But how they can get to, let's say, league average there, which is, I think, what they need to do to be really competitive.
Well, the good news is, when Marc Gasol has been in the game, they have a 3.7 net rating. The defense has been fantastic. And all of their team-wide stats are totally skewed by that huge blowout when they didn't bring any of their guys.
The JV squad.
In Minnesota. I mean, they've gotten some decent play out of James Ennis. He's shooting the ball pretty well. He has a 6.18 true shooting percentage, not terrible usage. He's been a support player, but he's been shooting the ball while he's getting on the offensive glass also. So I think maybe he ends up being kind of their small ball four option. Like, maybe he and Parsons would start, maybe instead of Jamichael Green, depending on what they need more of. Green has been doing okay as well. He hasn't been bad, his individual statistics. And Mike Conley, in limited minutes, has a 23.3 PR. So there's some reason for optimism here. And as they get guys like Andrew Harrison and Wade Baldwin, both of whom have played well over 100 minutes already, they get those guys out of the rotation and get the real guys back, hopefully they can take a step forward. But yeah, I mean, the margin is just razor thin for these guys. Fortunately for them, they specialize in winning razor thin margin games. This is a team that, more so than any other team, seems to outperform its point differential every year. Maybe that'll happen again. They're certainly well on their way to doing that this year, although they still are only 3-4. And this whole thing, all right, we're going to rest Conley, we're going to rest Gasol, that works great when you're solidly in the playoffs, but they don't have a cushion right now. And so when they don't play Gasol and they don't play Conley, this team has no chance of winning.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to kind of develop that. And it's part of the reason why they had that split of, like, we liked their offseason, but we didn't think they were going to be super, like, you know, like high end playoff team this year. And it's because they don't have depth in a way that they can handle that. You think about, you know, some of the teams, even like, you know, the Jazz are probably the high point of that, but even the Nuggets, you know, the Nuggets can handle losses of various guys, but just the way that Memphis is built, they're very reliant on a small group of people. And it's a sustainable strategy if those guys stay healthy, but as they get older, it's tough.
So we all love watching our teams, if I still had a team, but if I did, I would love to watch it win in a blowout. And so if you find out just before the game that Marc Gasol and Mike Conley are going to be sitting out against your team, you should go to SeatGeek immediately and buy yourself some tickets, because you are almost certainly going to see your team win that game. SeatGeek is always the first place I go to look at tickets for a game or for concerts. Danny was in the ticket business for a long time. He knows how good SeatGeek is. Everything about it is designed to make life easier for sports and music fans. They do all the price comparison for you, so you don't have to go to 8 sites then you worry, oh, if I don't go to the 9th, I'm going to miss out on some deal. They'll bring it together for you now. They search multiple ticket sites and ensure that you get the best possible deal. They do all the work, you save time and money. What's more, SeatGeek is given a grade based on value for your ticket, so you'll immediately see any underpriced seats and you'll be able to find the best deals that fit your budget. And of course, it would not be a dunked on ad if you didn't A, get a discount, and B, have a way to track it so they know that you came from us. So in this case, the cap space code is the way to go. You go into the settings tab of that free SeatGeek app that you've downloaded, click add a promo code, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first SeatGeek purchase. So download that free SeatGeek app, enter promo code CAPSPACE in the settings tab, and get your $20 after you've made your first purchase. The Wolves are 1-4. We'll start with this question again for them. Anything change fundamentally? I think we're high on them. I want to say that you had their over, right?
I had their over, yeah.
And it was 40.5 or 41.5. I can't remember.
I think it was 40.5. That's what I'm thinking of. I think I'm lower also. I mean, the results have to factor into it, because they're just a little bit further along. There's this parallel with teams where like their crunch time offense can really grind down. I covered when they were up in Sacramento and just kind of fell apart in the third quarter. That's actually been kind of a hallmark for them so far. Yeah,
they've gotten destroyed like every third quarter this year. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, so you have that sort of a thing. And it's also a year where you're going to figure it out. So one of the things that you had in kind of the outline was how many minutes has Karl Anthony Towns played without a traditional big? And so I narrowed out the, you know, the Jengs and Jordan Hill and just kind of those types of guys. So really, I left Beale Tsimpane in.
Cole Aldrich.
Yeah. He's played 17 minutes without those guys. So that is something Thibodeau, you know, kind of that old stereotype of
liking. How'd they do during big. Those minutes? Do you remember?
Their offense was actually pretty bad. I think they scored like 0.8 something. So like 82 points per 100 possessions or something in that range. I can't remember defensively. But, you know, I think overall those will work. But it also could be a sample size issue just because the Wolves haven't been as good when Ricky Rubio's out. And that should not be a major surprise to the people who kind of appreciated what his value was to this franchise over the last few years when they always went off a cliff when he was out due to injury.
Yeah, and we still don't know how long he is going to be out for. On their bench, too, they have not been getting much. Brandon Rush, whatever magic he seemed to have found last year with the Warriors, he just cannot hit an open three. He is a 2.5 PR, 35% true shooting. So he has struggled. Cole Aldrich as well has not been able to put together the same performance that he did last year. Tyus Jones has been struggling with his efficiency. Chris Dunn, 45% true shooting, turning it over on 22% of his possessions, even though he doesn't have a high usage. And that's not good when you have a guy who can't shoot and is also low usage. Like, he's probably hurting the defense pretty badly. So I think they're getting a lot out of Towns. He is been absolutely fantastic. We'll talk a little bit more about him. I think Wiggins and Levine have been solid. Wiggins was supposedly going to get more rebounds this year. He's still only getting 7.4% of defensive rebounds, but they got plenty of other guys who are doing that between Dang and Towns and Zach Levine, who's actually an underrated rebounder. Chris Dunn is a great rebounder too. So it's not the end of the world that he's not getting those rebounds. He's at least not turning it over. He's been relatively efficient. So I think the problem is they're not getting that much from some of these other guys. It'll be interesting to see whether Shabazz Muhammad starts getting more time. He's actually has been pretty solid offensively, but, you know, not well known as the headiest defender, but it'll be interesting to see whether he or Rush plays more. They've both played about the same number of minutes right now. And I don't care what Rush is doing defensively. If he's going to shoot like this, like, you got to play Muhammad over him.
Is it time for me to go on my little tirade about how frustrated I am that they're underutilizing Karl Anthony Towns?
How would you have them be utilizing him more?
Putting the ball in his hands.
Yeah.
However you want to do it, he's a solid enough passer, but I like him having the ball with his hands with a little bit more space. I think that...
Yeah, like facing up, I think from like 20 feet, he's been unstoppable in the games that I've watched.
Yeah, and he can do well even against power forwards. I mean, I'm still a believer in playing him with a floor spacing four, because then teams just don't really have a way to handle him. It's the same way I would do DeMarcus Cousins for exactly the same reason, broadly. And they just haven't done that. So like, there was this stretch in the Kings game where he was just getting a lot of good shots and doing well, and then they just kind of moved away from him. They went to other things. When Rubio went down, they were doing a lot of Wiggins initiated pick and rolls, and Wiggins can create these kind of like mid-range twos for himself, but he can't really find other people on those sorts of things. And
yeah, 6.7% assist percentage for Andrew Wiggins, which is horrendous when you consider that Towns, who is a center, has a 17%, and even Levine, who's a total gunner, is much higher. So yeah, I mean, Wiggins just does not pass the ball. I mean, and that's, you'd say, hey, this guy is a 28% usage, 56 true shooting, that's above the league average, like, he must be really helping. And then, you know, he's not doing anything else in any of the other box score stats.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, with the way they're using him offensively, it might be better to run a stagger and just play him without Towns and let them do other stuff. And
yeah, they are doing the all bench unit, and I don't think that's been particularly effective. I'll look that up actually while you're going to make your next point.
Yeah, so I think that the challenge with using Karl Anthony Towns is that you want to do a couple of specific things with him. So I think it's great to have the ball with him in space. I think our jaws are still a little bit on the floor from that move that he pulled on, I think that was, yeah, it was on Memphis in the opener.
Oh, he had like five more of those last night too against the Thunder when he dropped 25 in the first half.
Yeah, so I mean, he has that in his skill set. And Jang, I mean, part of the reason I didn't like the extension is that I don't think he complements what Towns does well offensively. You can say maybe he does defensively, because they have used Jang and sometimes as the center defensively, and I'm sure that helps Towns, even if it's just physical, just less wear and tear. But they need to remember that they have this special kid, and that you want to run, you know, you don't want to run him ragged, but you want to run a lot through him. And you can look at even like something like Anthony Davis, where the idea where, you know, even though not everything works perfectly, moving more things through him can be a positive for them. And thinking of lineups about being conducive, you know, they've done a lot of just kind of Wiggins isn't the greatest floor spacer and a lot of the other guys around them. And so it's frustrating in that sense that they're really not piecing
Wiggins
together.
Is shooting the ball very well from three,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, he's doing a solid job, and he's an overall, it's just that people don't necessarily respect it yet, and that is,
yeah,
something.
No, I agree,
that is something, but, well, that's important.
So one thing I want to say about Towns, I mean, watching that OKC game, he's already, I think, a better ISO scorer than Davis. He has a ton of moves off the dribble. Like, he had this one move, he started on the right wing against Joffrey Lavernia, went to his left, got to about the right elbow, and then did a reverse between the legs, like back to front, and then like went in for a layup. It was just like, for a 7-footer, is ridiculous. And just having him have the freedom to do that, he was coming off screens for threes as well. Like, that's ridiculous. And then when he gets someone smaller on him, he can just go right through those guys as well. So there's really, I mean, you never really, and the other thing that's been really effective too is when he runs a pick and roll or a pick and pop, if they throw it to him at the top and he's, you know, 20 feet from the basket, he's so fast that there's no way that the guy guarding him can get back in front, and he's just shot out of a cannon, just goes right down the lane and either will make a pass or usually can score off 1 foot. He's a great leaper off of 1 foot, not as much off of two.
And when you think about help defense, generally speaking, if teams are going to put their centers on him, another reason to use the stretch four, most teams have a much shakier secondary rim protector, help defender at that spot. And Towns is so good at a size mismatch that you kind of, it's the same thing with DeMarcus Cousins, where you don't want to put your four on him because he can attack that in other ways.
One of the interesting strategic things that I always want to see when the Wolves play someone is, does the other team center guard Towns or guard Dang? And Oklahoma City, for example, put Steven Adams on Towns, and he still got lit up anyway. Steven Adams is probably one of the better matchups, you would think, for someone like Towns, and still couldn't stop him at all in that first half. But the bigger concern, too, is that you noted that the Wolves are doing really well on the offensive glass, but they really just got punked overall by the size of Oklahoma City, and Oklahoma City was just getting right to the rim. They did not, Towns has not really looked very good protecting the basket so far this year. Dang has always kind of, you would think he would be good. He has that reputation, but never that good statistically. So that's something that they're going to clean up. Like, they're going to have to get a little tougher. I'm sure that was one of the big things that Thibodeau was talking about there.
He said that after the Kings game, like, I think it was before or after, about 50 times he said the word tough.
So I don't know. I thought, I picked them for 40 wins and I had them making the playoffs. I don't feel as good about that right now, especially with Denver looking a little bit better. But we'll see. I think they're going to come around. I think Tibbs will get them to start playing a little bit better.
I'll say one more thing. It could be one of those seasons where it's like their record isn't great, but they still look a lot better. And in certain ways, as long as the expectations game wasn't out of control, that could be a good thing for them to just get one more guy.
By the way, I did look up how their bench was doing, and all those guys have crazy good net ratings because of that ridiculous game that they played against Memphis. So that data is like kind of useless, unfortunately. What do you got to say about the 0-6 New Orleans Pelicans?
A lot. But the Pelicans have Anthony Davis, who is seventh in the league in PER, who has been, broadly speaking, an absolute demon this season, and they're 29th in offensive rating.
Yeah, they, again, really don't have anyone else. Tim Frazier is the only other guy on this team who can dribble. They were relying on Lance Stephenson, and now he's torn his groin. He's going to need surgery, and he's actually going to get released for Archie Goodwin. And Archie Goodwin is probably actually going to have to play on this team for that very reason until Drew Holiday comes back, just, again, to have someone with some kind of an impetus going to the basket. For all that, though, they have not been that bad. I mean, they've had some pretty brutal losses.
Suns game.
Yeah, that Phoenix one on Saturday was just so bad. They had a nice lead. they lost it. Devin Booker hit like some crazy shot to send it into overtime on the baseline, and then they're up by one with 7 seconds left. Earl Watson and his staff drew up a great play that had someone running all the way into the backcourt, and then TJ Warren cut to the ball and then went hard backdoor and got a dunk completely uncontested, and then the Pels were out of timeouts and they couldn't get a shot.
It was hard to watch. I mean, because you're sitting there, and also, you know, with New Orleans trying so hard to get their first win, and they've been close. You know, this isn't a team that's getting the doors blown off them every single game, and they're just not able to get over the hump. And something that I looked up, because I was just interested, was, so the New Orleans is scoring 97.4 points per 100 possessions, so, you know, all right, with Davis on the floor. They're actually a positive in net rating with him on the bench, but they're only scoring 86.4 per 100. So their defense has been better than their offense during that stretch, but both parts of that just kind of have to scare you a little bit.
Well, the defense doesn't scare me that much. I think the fact that they are defending okay, that's how I thought this team was going to win games. I mean, this is, again, not that many games, but at least you would hope that, hey, they've had some pretty decent games. They've played some tough teams, and they're still 10th in defensive rating. That's like, they haven't even sniffed the top 10 in defense, you know, since they basically, since George Shin owned the team, since the Chris Paul era. So that's encouraging. You would think, all right, maybe if Jrue Holiday comes back, they can just get to passable on offense. Maybe Tyreke Evans can give them something. He's supposed to come back in November. You get just something from Quincy Pondexter, although I'm kind of viewing him as and Evans as well as maybe just kind of, you know, gravy, basically. I don't see them as guys I'm counting on to come back. But nonetheless, like, if they could just keep this defense up, this team could actually be okay. But they're already 0-6, you know, so it's, they've banked so many losses, and Holiday is still, we don't know when he's going to come back. Nothing has been announced there. So they could just be out of it again by the time they get back to playing decently.
They've also played 24 what are counted as crunch time clutch minutes for NBA.com, which is within five points or closer within the last 5 minutes, which is second most in the league. And, you know, you can kind of see that a few different ways, but the problem is they've been absolutely demolished during that time. They've been outscored by 24.6 points per 100. And so I think you can construe that as a positive in that it is unrealistically bad, but you still have to, you know, you still have to be able to turn those around sometimes.
Solomon Hill is giving them very, very little. Part of that is because he's playing the three, which is not the position he should be playing. He should be playing at the four. And he's not getting that many open shots, but he's not hitting him either. Buddy Hield has been terrible. He can't make a shot. Langston Galloway, they haven't gotten much out of him. Etuan Moore has been fine. I think he actually had like 38 points the other day. But really, there's just nobody on this team that can do anything with the ball in their hands other than AD. And even in that game against the Suns, PJ Tucker was guarding him. He did an unbelievable job. AD only took two shots in like the 20 minutes that Tucker was guarding because he was just fronting him. And then there was no spacing, so there's so much help on the back. Like, they couldn't even get AD a touch, and they were just switching, and then they were fronting again. Like, it was really, really awful just how few threats they have on this team outside of AD.
Yeah, it really has been concerning, and they will get better just getting Jrue back. If Tyreke Evans can ever play again, he can certainly help them just to be another guy who can create. But, you know, as you said, the timing of this is certainly unfortunate.
Who do we have more hope for, them or the Mavs, as far as like getting back to being a contender in the playoffs?
So they both dealt with injuries, but I think that New Orleans has lost more due to that. And so I'm a little bit more hopeful about New Orleans. But at the same point, it's part of the reason it's so close is because I believe in Carlisle in some ways more than I believe in the structural factors that favor New Orleans.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Just because they have that institutional knowledge in Dallas, and games like today's against the Bucks, when they're in a close game, you kind of trust them to grind things out. Whereas New Orleans does not have that kind of track record. And of course, they've gotten demolished.
We've seen the wheels fall off New Orleans so recently in the past that, you know, it's harder to see them, you know, rallying from this and doing it because it didn't happen last year.
Oklahoma City, they are 5-1, a little bit misleading. They have a 1.9 net rating. They are fourth in defense. That's good. 24th in offense. That's bad. But that's kind of where I thought this team was going to be. I thought they would be able to defend pretty well and they would just have no spacing and not be able to score at all.
I did not believe in their defense. I just didn't. I watched a fair amount of their preseason because they happened to play those games in Spain that were at a time that I was just sitting around doing writing work. And I thought that they were going to struggle more. It is worth noting that Steven Adams missed a fair amount of time on that trip. I think he sprained his ankle, and of course he's fine now. Just signed.
Yeah, I think Roberson wasn't playing either.
Yeah, I think Roberson might have missed some of that time too. I think their defense is going to come back a little bit just because they have some players. Like I don't see Russ as at this point in his career as being that like great defender, and also their second unit guys playing Laverne, playing Enes Kanter, those sorts of things. Also, you know, their first three games, while they played a great defensive effort against the Clippers, their first three games were against the Sixers, the Suns, and the Lakers. And while the Lakers have looked better, you know, those are not exactly juggernauts, and they're still kind of propping up some of their defensive stats.
That game they played against Minnesota was a demolition, though, and that's probably by far the best game they've played. Steven Adams really dominated in the post against pretty much anyone that they put on him. I think that Oklahoma City should go there more. His overall numbers on post-ups are not that great, but he's really has that quick spin move that we've talked about. He has like a hook shot coming across the lane. He can shoot that with the left. Also, doesn't really have any kind of a turnaround jump shot at all, and he'll also get deep position, and he's just stronger and bigger than a lot of the people who are going to be guarding him. And especially when he's in there with Kanter, one of those two guys is going to have a post-up mismatch. Now you can help off of them. There's that issue, but especially for a team that's going to be challenged to score, especially when Westbrook is out of the game, then I think that's something that they should try to go to more. Now he still is not. The next step is like once you're actually good in the post, teams will start to help and you have to become a passer. I don't think that he's going to be able to do that yet. They also are just playing these lineups that have no spacing. We talked about Roberson. They're playing Jeremy Grant at the three. And I think they're starting to play Abrines a little more just to get some guys out there who can shoot. He may have a little bit of time, though, to get. He is a pure shooter, but a lot of those guys just have a little bit of trouble adapting to the NBA three-point line. Any other thoughts on them that you want to share?
Well, one note that you had in here, which is something that I've noticed too, is Russell Westbrook's frustration fouls.
Oh yeah, that's right. I think it was Royce Young actually tweeted about this too, that when he goes up for a layup that he misses and he thinks he gets fouled, he'll just grab whoever gets the rebound. number one, because he wants to make a point, but number two, it's actually if your point guard misses a layup, that's usually going to be a fast break for the other team, so it's actually like not a terrible time for an intentional foul, but it's still like a pretty funny affectation. Another thing I want to look at too is how they have played without Russell Westbrook on the floor, and they actually have an 8.9 net rating when Russ is out there, highlighted by that Warriors game where they got killed when he went out, and Steven Adams as well, 13.2 net rating. Roberson as well, very good. So when their starters are out there, they've been excellent. And then when Russ is off the floor, they've really struggled quite a bit. Negative 15.2 net rating without him, negative 18.3 without Steven Adams. Again, those guys usually play together and they are a great pick and roll combo, but they might want to consider splitting those guys up a little bit. And the big problem without Russ, of course, is just that they can't score 85.7 points per 100 in the 88 minutes that he has not played so far this season.
One other thing I want to mention for them is that this is a very interesting week of games because they have very different opponents and they're at home the whole time. So they play Miami, Toronto, the Clippers, and the Magic in the Serge Ibaka return game.
Phoenix, 2-5. I'll ask you too, how do you feel about how they have played relative to expectations? To me, they're kind of right in line. I'm actually slightly encouraged.
I'm a little bit encouraged too. I mean, their starting five has been better than I expected. TJ Warren, professional scorer, has done a nice job. Eric Bledsoe's looked solid. Chandler, you know, he's closer to being, let's call it, normal than before. And that is important. They can figure out some of the bench issues they've had later on, but the starters being solid is enough for me at the moment.
Yeah, Tyson Chandler has looked pretty decent. We worried that he was going to be bad because he had some recurrence of the hamstring issues that he had, but that hasn't been the case so far. And with their starters on the floor, they've been like pretty close to even, maybe a little bit worse than that. But then when you get into Marquise Chris, Knight has been awful so far. That's really been an underrated story. Earl Watson was talking about how he could be a six-man award candidate, and instead he just has not been able to get going at all. 8.3 PER, totally inefficient despite a huge usage rate as trying to be the primary scorer off the bench. And he's also shooting a mere 26% on three-pointers and not making up for it with his two-point percentage either. So it's really been a struggle for him. You have to imagine he'll come around a little bit, but we thought, oh, maybe we're going to see a lot of Bledsoe, Knight, and Booker together, and we have not seen that at all. Knight just hasn't been playing well enough to where they want to do that, and Warren has been really good. He's been really efficient for them so far, and their best scorer by quite a bit.
Yeah, and Booker, broadly speaking, has looked good. I think that he's had some nice moments, and he is showing a little bit more depth of his game, even though shooting is still his bread and butter.
It needs to be more of his bread and butter. I think it's been a lot of long twos for him, and for all the progress that he showed last year, he was not efficient, and still he had this great game today where he really got on fire and he had 39 points, but he also really was not been able to create for others. He hasn't been able to come off screens and get open for threes. He's not spacing the floor as much as you would hope. A guy who's allegedly a great shooter, he showed a ton in his ability to operate in pick and roll and do more going to the basket, but it'd be nice if he actually could like space the floor and shoot some shots a little bit more too, and work around Eric Bledsoe, because he is only shooting 39% on the year right now.
Yeah, so I think even if we're more or less positive on it, it still feels like they're just kind of outside of the playoff picture, but kind of maybe a little bit feisty game to game. Does that seem fair to you?
Yeah, I think so. Another thing too is that Alex Len, one of the things I said is that he needs to kind of cut the bullshit out of his game. Just taking bad long twos, 48 true shooting percentage, 21% usage. Again, now he's playing on this second unit quite a bit, but it's where there's not a ton of scoring. But how about you just focus on making the shots that you can make first before you try to become like some big post-up, or mid-range jump shooter, and focus a little bit more on defense. And they predictably have been really bad when he's been on the floor.
Yeah. Ready to move on to Portland?
4-3 for the Blazers. They have been pretty good with the first unit. Would you like to take a guess as to who is third on this team in minutes? This is going into the game today when I looked this up.
I'm hoping it's Al-Farouq Aminu, but I don't think it is.
Mo Harkless, actually, was the answer. And Mo Harkless also best net rating on the team. This is another reason why I was critical of that Turner signing, because I felt like they had plenty of guys. I think like Mo Harkless could be pretty good. He hasn't been shooting it amazingly, but still that starting lineup that killed it at the end of last year and was good in the playoffs continues to be excellent.
Yeah, and Portland had this dynamic that worked with their starting lineup, and surprise, surprise, that part's working again. And there are these weird questions with like how their big man rotation is going to work out and all these sort of things, but the core of Dame and CJ works. I think Aminu works at the four there. Plumlee, we talked about that a little bit over the week, and it's just figuring out everything else. And one of the problems with them, though, is that there isn't a lot that they can do to shake it up, because they didn't add really kind of like lottery tickets at positions other than big.
I think one of the issues with their second unit as well is that they are playing two bigs, whether it's Davis and Vonleh or Davis and Leonard, which worked okay last year. And they're also struggling to score with Evan Turner on the floor. He actually has had some games where he's hit some long twos. I'm not sure how much of that is his fault directly, but they have been hurt pretty badly when that second unit has been out there, like a lot of these teams, really. So it's at some point we'll get to a team that has a really good bench. I guess we just haven't yet.
Well, Sacramento's isn't too bad.
Oh, other question about the Blazers. Any change in preseason expectations for them based on this first go around? I think they're kind of right about where I thought they would be personally.
No, right in line.
Yeah, at 4-3. The Kings looked like they were headed for just an absolute nadir at 2-5. And then they shockingly came out and had a very nice win, excellent defense against the Raptors on the road to now go to 3-5. And what do you think about this team? I think thought that they might be decent, probably not a playoff team. They've had some moments where they've looked pretty good. What do you think about them?
I think back to that game against the Spurs where they were just more competitive than we expected. And, you can really take some positives from that, even though they didn't win the game. But at the same point, the challenge for them in terms of making the playoffs is that they really have to put it together such a high proportion of the time to really make it work. And they've gotten some good performances from Gay and Cousins, and they have depth, but they don't really have depth that can carry. They have just an arsenal of support pieces.
Well, it's interesting. Gay actually has a 7.4 net rating in his seven games. He missed the game against Milwaukee when they got completely destroyed last night. And Cousins, they've been fine when he's been on the floor, about even. And then really everyone else, it's been a struggle. And I think part of the reason why they've been effective with Gay on the floor is just he's the only guy who can do anything off the dribble on this team.
Yeah, that's a big problem. And they've been missing Darren Collison, of course, and they were able to use a couple of days of the Collison suspension to get a replacement in, because you can't for the first five games of a suspension. But that Jordan Farmar is not going to solve their problems.
No, they really need Collison back, because Ty Lawson, although he has looked quicker, he really just is not the answer, certainly as a starting point guard, because he just can't score anymore. You know, he's been a good passer. He's been good at getting them into transition. Hasn't been as horrible on defense as he was last year. But really, that's the issue, is that he is not shooting a three very reluctantly, not getting into the paint or getting to the rim. Only a 13% usage. I mean, for a guy who used to be such a pillar of an offense as recently as 2 years ago, even though he looks kind of better, he still doesn't seem to have the confidence trying to score. And so we've seen this team, especially once Cousins fouled out in that Miami game in particular, they just have nowhere to go. It's just Rudy Gay ISOing. And frankly, like, that actually probably was their best play for a lot of these. The Anthony Tolliver and Aaron Aflalo, their free agent signings, have looked really bad so far. Aflalo, 6.2 PR, only 15% usage, which is really low. And you'd think he could at least be efficient with that low usage, but he's only 44% true shooting. So that's been really bad. And then they are fouling like crazy as well, highlighted, of course, by Cousins.
Yeah, I mean, so there are a lot of different ways that you can quantify fouling, but the way that I like to is free throw attempt rate. I mentioned it for a few other teams. They're the league worst at 0.374. That is an insanely high rate. You are dealing with a small sample size, but last year the Grizzlies were the worst at 0.326. So that's basically 5% more than the Grizzlies were doing last year, which was already a lot. Something else I wanted to mention with them, just because for teams like that, that it can be on kind of shaky ground at moments, it can be informative to look at their schedule. So they have two winnable games at the Golden One Center against the Pelicans and the Lakers, and then they have this brutal stretch in terms of opponents, not in terms of locations, where they go at Portland and then at home Spurs, Clippers, Raptors. So just if they can, you know, if they're sitting there at, let's say, you know, 4-10, hopefully for them they're gonna be like more like five or six wins, that can be a little bit tougher to take, because you just get those in a barrage, and since they're home games, you're not really making up that margin.
Yeah, so they better win these games against the Lakers and against the Pels, is what you're saying here, to get back to 5-5, and then maybe they go through this tough stretch, they can get one of those games and still be hanging around. Because if they're going to be at 4-6 going into that tough stretch, and then, you know, like you said, they're 4-9, 4-10 on the back end of that, it's going to be same old Kings again, you know. And I think this is a team that has such a level of mental fragility, and we'll see. You know, I think subjectively, I think their defenses look good at times, but they also have had some really bad defensive games, including that Milwaukee game where they got absolutely lit up. So it'll be interesting to see where they fall. They have some defensive talent on this squad, and I think that they can get there, but, you know, it's going to take a more consistent effort, because they have had good defensive games, but they also have had some total clunkers.
How do you feel about the Spurs so far?
Yeah, I thought it was great. I didn't think that Utah game was the end of the world. Getting completely destroyed by the Clippers, a game that I haven't had a chance to watch the whole part of yet, was a little bit disturbing, especially when you consider these teams matching up. And this is a team that was so dominant at home. They only lost their first game at home, you'll remember, in the last week of the season to the Warriors. They went 40-1 at home last year. So to lose two games in, you know, relatively blowout fashion, a little bit disturbing. And then the other thing too is just that the old dudes haven't been good.
Yeah, that's a big problem for them, though they have other pieces, and that's part of what makes the Spurs different than other teams, is that they have other guys they can try. Tony Parker has a 5.3 PER. Powell has, has more, I would say the issues are more on the defensive end, but that makes sense considering he's a little bit older and you want to use him more as kind of like a stand under the basket, put his big arms up, more of that kind of defender. But they have guys like Patty Mills and Dwayne Dedman that can fill those spots, but that's a challenge when you're dealing with a franchise pillar in Tony Parker and a guy who you just paid a lot of money to and has a player option for next year in Pau Gasol.
Yeah, this is one of those teams that actually does have a really good bench. And Patty Mills, Dwayne Dedman, John Simmons, David Lee, even Manu, all those guys very much in the black, double-digit net ratings. And then you look down, Gasol, negative 1.2, and Parker, negative 11.3. And the problem is that they're not defending with those guys on the floor, as you said, especially those two guys together, I think is something that's going to be a bit of an issue. And again, you know, Pop, if there's any coach who could manage this situation with these proud veterans who aren't necessarily performing, Pop is it. But even if you're looking at a guy like Dedman or someone like Patty Mills taking over in the starting lineup, those guys are pretty good bench guys and the Spurs can get a lot out of them. But let's, you know, Patty Mills can't really do anything off the dribble. And they're going to need someone who can do that other than Kawhi when you look at their starting lineup with Danny Green, who's supposed to be back soon. And I think that'll help their defense as well to get him back. And then Dedman, while he has played well and he's catching the ball much better, he's been a force at blocking shots, he was still third string on the Magic last year. So it's not like I don't know that he is like just like a good quality starting center necessarily that we're at that point yet, despite the fact that it was a nice signing and he's played well. So I think we're kind of about where we thought it would be with this team. I think this team's going to win in the high 50s. You know, I feel pretty good about my 59 win prediction still. It doesn't look like the Warriors are necessarily going to run away and hide yet the way we thought that they were going to. The Clippers are looking pretty good. I think those three are still looking like they're going to be the class of the West, but nobody is killing it yet. So I think they'll be right there at least through second, third seed. But if they don't get home court against the Clippers, I don't see much chance of them beating them.
Because that'll also mean they're worse in the regular season. Even if the idea of the Spurs as a totality hasn't been surprising, Kawhi Leonard has been just incredible this season. And offensively, he's been better than you expected. And defensively, he's done a really good job. You know, he's been a stout defender for them. But, I mean, 33% usage, 35 PER, he's only behind James Harden. And we talked on when we did that Reddit mailbag about the idea of who is overrated and who is underrated by PER, and Harden and Kawhi might be two of the poster children that you would use for that.
Yeah, with Kawhi being underrated and Harden being overrated. The other thing, I mean, incredibly efficient as well for Kawhi, and this is even after he had a 3-for-13 clunker against the Clippers, still 63% true shooting. And only turns it over on 7.6% of his possessions, which is just ridiculously low. And he just does a lot of ISO scoring. He is great at getting into situations that he feels comfortable in, getting to his spots that he can control. And that's why he never turns the ball over.
Yeah, to his immense credit, like being able to kind of stay within, not really a lane, but to stay within that and do it. And something else I think feel like we have to mention with the Spurs at this point is that they are substantially ahead of the rest of the league in terms of defensive rebounding. It is a perk of playing two traditional bigs as much as they do. But so right now they're grabbing 84.3% of opponent misses, and next, I can't remember which team it is 82.2. So they're just a long way away from everybody else. Yeah. And
they're one
helps.
Of the best defensive rebounding teams in history last year, along with Charlotte. Although they did get beat up by Oklahoma City in the playoffs. And I think a lot of it is just kind of their strategy at this point. But you thought that maybe with Gasol, who's teams of defensive rebounded pretty poorly with him on the floor, despite his good superficial personal rebounds per game numbers, that it might be an issue. We'll see what happens in the playoffs with that. I think that it's something that actually could come back to hurt them in the playoffs if they go up against the wrong team like it did last year. But for now, I mean, they're just so disciplined. They just do such a great job that, yeah, I mean, that's a big reason why if you're holding opponents only less than 16% offensive rebounds, that's a great step towards having a good defense, even if you're just average everywhere else. Let's get to Utah.
I was gonna say, like, I feel like there's this
we're out of practice on this. Our transitions are garbage.
I feel like there's this weird thing with the Spurs where we have to deal with expectations with them. You know, it's kind of like they're 5-2. They beat the crap out of the Warriors, but it's still, that was a little bit further back and everything else. But it's like, you know, they've been rough this week, but overall they've just been doing
that. And they had a dominating win win at Utah before they lost to the Clippers at home. So I think like those kind of cancel each other out too a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I mean, starting out the year 4-0 before the Utah game, I mean, that's why that felt like such a weird anomaly.
They also
played
8 games already. They've played a ton of games. And I think that they're just kind of, you know, not playing their guys as many minutes. Like that Clippers game, Kawhi only played like 28 minutes or something. Partially, I'm sure, because it was a blowout. But so I think that's part of it too, that they're in those, with all the old guys they have, and especially with Green out, that they're not going to do as well in some of those concentrated game type of situations. Can we move on to Utah now?
Let's do it.
George Hill's pretty good, huh?
He is. This is not a surprise, but yeah, I mean, it's so.
It's a surprise that he's doing this well. He's been, yeah, that's true so far.
Well, yeah, and we'll see. Today was the first time that Gordon Hayward played after his whole finger issue, and he looked good. He looked good in that game against the Knicks, which they ended up winning despite New York going on the run, which feels like that old reliable of the Knicks going on a run and their game that starts at 12:30 on Sunday. But the Jazz were able to come back.
No, apparently their record in those games isn't that great.
But they're feels like, but you have to also keep in mind that the Knicks have been garbage for a while. So being yeah, under 500 there is not necessarily like, oh, they've been bad. I mean, I just remember just every once in a while, it feels like they just win a game for no reason, like where the other team is just so flat for completely unexplainable reasons on a game right after a Saturday night in New York. But George Hill has been great for them, and Utah has a lot of depth and they had to use it early, which is kind of strange, but I think overall they should be very happy with how they started.
Yeah, let's talk about Hill a little bit more. One of the big things that was a revelation for him, as we've talked about 2 years ago, was he was actually able to create in the pick and roll. Did not get those opportunities last year. Last year, he was 76th in the NBA, only 3.5 possessions per game, finishing with a shot or turnover out of the pick and roll. This year, 7.3 possessions per game, 15th in the NBA, and has been incredibly efficient both in those possessions and overall as well. I mean, the guy, he just has the skills. He gets guys on his back. He's able to shoot threes off the dribble if they go under. He's able to get to the rim. He's got the length to finish. He can find the roll man if need be. Like, he's just good at running pick and roll. And at a time when Hayward is went out, they really needed him. And then today, they busted out a lineup that I think a lot of people were very excited for, which was Joe Johnson at the four with Gobert at the five, or they might go Favors there too. I think I like Gobert a little bit better in that role as someone who can protect the rim a little bit more. And that lineup actually really killed the Knicks as they had a nice come from behind win and lit the Knicks up to 114 points in the Garden.
And there was a beautiful sequence by Rudy Gobert where he dunked all over Kristaps Porzingis, and then on the other end got a nice block where he was kind of, I felt like he was a little bit out of position and still got there anyway because his arms are so freaking long. And Gobert is going to need to have those sequences, not only the defensive part, but the offensive part, to really keep centers honest and to force teams to keep attention on him because they have so many other offensive talents.
Yeah, he obliterated Porzingis with the left too. It was really impressive. And really most of their main guys have been pretty good. They've really just struggled with Trey Lyles and Dante Exum on the floor. I think that those guys, once Boris Diaw comes back, and now that Hayward is back, those guys can get marginalized a little bit. They've really struggled to score with Exum on the floor. We've talked about how we don't think he's really quite ready yet as a point guard with his handle. And, you know, he'll show some flashes on occasion, but still, I don't know that he is really on a team that has this much depth. He may start to get marginalized a little bit, especially considering like how well Hill has been playing. And yeah, I mean, this is just, if they can just play even when their bench is on the floor, or even start to hurt teams when their bench is on the floor now, because they've been playing really well with guys like Joe Johnson, who's going to be on the bench as a starter, this is going to be a nasty team. They've been scoring really well. One issue, though, for them, you wonder if their amazing three-point shooting is going to come back to earth a little bit, especially Hill, who's just been completely on fire. So that could happen, but I think their defense is going to get better as well.
Yeah.
As of this juncture, they are right about middle of the pack in defense, 103 points per 100. But the offense has been pretty good, and they've played some pretty tough competition. They already played the Spurs twice. They played at the Clippers as well. So I'm feeling very good about them as, you know, being a high 40s, low 50 win team at the moment.
Well, yeah, their three losses, this is what I was getting to, was their three losses are at Portland, at the Clippers and against the Spurs, who they beat in San Antonio. So those are completely justifiable losses, especially when I think for Favors was limited for at least two of those games. Hayward was out for all of them. I think you have that, but I'm interested to see. So they're doing this weird road trip where they did two Atlantic teams, the Knicks and then the Sixers on Monday, back to back. And then they face the Southeast. So they have Charlotte, Orlando, and Miami. So if they can go through that 4-0, then we start to talk about maybe they're going to be in the mix with some of the other, you know, like maybe they can start to fight for the three, but more likely than not, they can start to strengthen their position in terms of being the four and maybe putting some ground between them and everyone else.
All right, we done here?
Yeah, can I plug some stuff?
Indubitably.
So I'm going to do a Reddit mailbag. I'm actually going to record it after this for Locked On Warriors, which is going to be fun. Already did a little bonus podcast about the Laker game. I just had some thoughts I had to get out about that. Of course, writing for The Athletic. And then for those of you who didn't read it, I wrote a piece on James Harden. And really, it's been funny. I was reading a Reddit thread that kind of misconstrued what I was getting at from the piece. But the idea was really about what they could have done with the year and a half that they could have waited on trading him and how they would have seen how the CBA changed and that it wasn't this financial burden that they thought it would be.
Yeah, man. Never read the comment sections.
Now, oh, and one other thing.
That's actually not true. We read that stuff all the time.
Yeah, we read a lot.
We're trying to get better.
I recorded a Real GM Radio with Sam Vecenie, NBA draft expert, about talking. We didn't do as much specific player-by-player analysis. It was more setting up the season, who to look for, and some of the larger trends in terms of positions, scarcities, and things like that.
All right, we'll be back tomorrow night, but don't forget about our sponsors in the interim. Helix Sleep, helixsleep.com/catspace. Get yourself a customized mattress and $50 off it as well by going to that URL. And then, of course, SeatGeek, $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase via rebate. Go into the settings tab of that SeatGeek app and enter promo code CAPSPACE to redeem that $20. Talk to you all next time.